The music here is such an instrument to lead us in worship and praise. And thank you for all who minister in music. Don't ever do what I did to the president of Ambassador this morning. Don't ever do it. I kept him hanging till the very last minute about whether or not I was going to show up. And my only excuse, and it's a very bad one, my only excuse is that I'm not used to these grading curves, and I was slipping and sliding all over a Daniel revelation, a grading curve, and I just slid the wrong way. I slid down toward the bamboo and the sheep, and I do apologize. Enjoy the chapel service, Daniel Revelation students, if you will, please. This is a place that God has made and is making a very special place for His glory. It's a privilege to serve here. I like it here. I learn here. I learn from each of you. I'm grateful for the honor to be here and to preach. I've been listening to preaching. That is, being able to grasp at least some of it. I've been listening to preaching since I was about 5 years of age. I locked in pretty early in my life, always being a rather serious individual. That's just the way I'm put together. So I've been listening to preaching for about 67 years now. And we have heard in our chapel services this semester some of the finest preaching that I've ever heard in my life. I had the privilege to listen to R.G. Lee and Lester Roloff and John Phillips, but really, we've heard some of the finest preaching I've heard in 6 to 7 years of paying attention this semester in chapel right here. Hasn't it been good? For God's glory. We all must try to keep walking softly before the Lord as faculty members, administrators, students. We need to keep walking as my father used to pray, softly before the Lord, because we could lose very quickly what God is doing here. A student or five might decide they want to strike off on some doctrinal emphasis that is not what they agreed upon when they signed up. A group of students could start to lobby and just work behind the scenes. Or a faculty member could get his nose out of joint and hurt the whole thing. Let's walk softly before the Lord so we don't spoil what God wants to keep doing here. Jane and I do ask you to pray for Jane's mother, Evelyn Sloat. Mother is just a few months shy of 100. She has macular degeneration and other health issues. She can't read the labels on her medication, and she was having a blood pressure issue just yesterday and confused about her medication. She phoned and said, "I don't know what's going on." So pray for Evelyn Sloat. She was a missionary in Nigeria for 41 years, but she needs our prayers right now. This poem was born in the crush, squeeze, pressure days of the work in Waterloo, Canada. The church exploded in growth. I just was allowed by God to be in the right place at the right time. Schools and denominations were going liberal. Mennonites were coming back from Goshen College. Mennonites were coming back to Waterloo County, Canada, and saying, "You know, we're getting a new hymn book. We don't need these songs about the blood anymore." And God just gave me the privilege to be in the right place at the right time. Statistics do not tell the story. Fast growth doesn't tell the whole story. But that work was growing very, very fast. I could hardly keep up with it. But along with fast growth goes the crush, the squeeze. And when conservatives from various movements are looking for a flag to follow, those conservatives will bring their pet peeves and their hobby horses in, and you're expected to try to preach the Bible and remember what the hobby horses are of four or five different groups. So there was pressure in those days. But I wouldn't change it. I saw this verse in Exodus 27:20. And thou shalt bring thee pure oil. Pure oil. Olive oil. Beaten for the light to cause the lamp to burn always. Thou shalt bring thee pure oil, olive, beaten for the light to cause the lamp to burn always. So the sermon was born out of that text, and then for the sermon, this poem was born. It's called Beaten But Burning. Let me be beaten. If beaten, I burn. Let me be spanked. If spanked, I learn. Let me be crushed. If crushed, I yearn to bring healing to others and compassionate head to turn out where there's hurt and bruises and pain, out to the weeping widow of Nain, out to the highway, the hedge and the lane, to bring loving to others who've sought for a Gilead in vain. Let me be broken. If broken, I'll care. Let me be dying. If dying, I'll bear the message of life to someone somewhere, straining, groping for grace. Oh, beat till I'm fluid and there. Beat till I'm lost in running his race. Beat till his image is stamped in my place. Beat till I flow in sovereignty's vase to bring Jesus to others. Oh, beat till I mirror his face. God uses the beatings and the crushings of life, if we respond properly, to make us like Christ, whose life overflowed like the fluid of olive oil to heal the lives of others. Now would you turn, please, to Exodus 3, and let's stand if health permits. Exodus chapter 3, please. Exodus chapter 3, we'll begin at verse 1. Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight. Why, the bush is not burnt, as in burnt up or consumed. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here am I. And the Lord said, Draw not nigh hither, put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Now turn over to the Revelation, Revelation chapter 4, Revelation chapter number 4 and verse 4. I will be reading selected portions, of these verses in the interest of time. It's all inspired, but I just want to hit phrases that will carry the meaning of the narrative. Revelation 4:4. And round about the throne were 24 seats, and upon the seats I saw 24 elders sitting. Verse 5. And out of the throne proceeded lightnings and thunderings and voices. And there were 7 lamps of fire burning. There's the fire again. And the lamps were burning before the throne. 6. And before the throne there was a sea of glass like unto crystal. And round about the throne were 4 beasts. Verse 9. And when those beasts give glory and honor and thanks to him that sat on the throne, who liveth forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down and worship him and cast their crowns before the throne, saying, Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for thou hast created all things, and for thy pleasure they are and were created. Turn for a final passage at this point to Revelation 8:1. Revelation 8, verse 1. And when he had opened the 7th seal, there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour. Please be seated. My text is a different passage, Psalm 4:4, which reads, Stand in awe and sin not. Stand in awe and sin not. I'm convinced that we do not do an injustice to the text if we say that the text implies that if we don't stand in awe, we will sin. And that's what sometimes happens with pastors and Bible teachers and evangelists and Christian college students. We fail to stand in awe. And so before we know it, we're in sin. A lingering look, a video, it's ungodly. Are you in awe of God today? Am I? I speak to myself as much to anyone. Am I right now in awe of God? Or has he become old hat to me? Moses had it, Isaiah had it, Ezekiel had it, and John the Beloved, whom God used to record the revelation, had it. All over the person and works of Almighty God. Have you left your first awe? You thought I was going to say something else. But I'm trying to get you to lock in and pay attention today, as you all are. I'm trying to get us to lock in by rephrasing that statement from the Revelation. Have you lost your first awe? Were you amazed when you were saved? Did it thrill you? Did it stir you? Did you think it was pretty big stuff? That the God of forever, who made everything, loved you enough to send his son, who shed his blood and hurt a great deal physically in the process, to keep you out of hell. Does that doctrine still amaze you the way it did the first few days or weeks? The poet G. Manley Hopkins wrote, The earth is charged with the grandeur of God. But he went on in his poem and said, we miss it. The earth is charged, just chock full of the grandeur of God. But we miss it. And then he finished, nor can foot feel being shod. Nor can foot feel being shod. Elizabeth Barrett Browning said, earth's crammed with heaven, and every common bush aflame with God, but only those who take off their shoes see. The earth is crammed with the glory of God, but only those who take off their shoes see. It was A.W. Tozer who asked, are we losing our O? As in, oh, God. A number of things I detest in our deteriorating culture. I detest most commercials, and I detest the OMG. It's blasphemous. And you get these people on Fox News with their OMG. It's a violation of the command of God. It's wicked. But that's just how casual American culture, by and large, has gotten with a God that should rather evoke, oh, hush my mouth. It is possible that because you're here in a Bible college, you could get to the place where you think very little more of singing great hymns than you do of chewing gum. I'm not against chewing gum, but surely singing How Great Thou Art and Amazing Grace ought to involve more connection, turning on of our brain, than just chewing gum or playing billiards. Are we just, here we go again, another chapel. There are millions of people in the world who would crawl on their hands and knees if they could be in a service like this. They put their lives on the line when they come to a service like this. So Tozer asks us, are we losing our He continues, when the heart on its knees moves into the awesome presence and hears with fear and wonder things not lawful to utter, the mind falls flat. And words fail us, and so we say, oh, Jesus, the very thought of thee with sweetness fills my breast, but sweeter far thy face to see. And in thy presence, rest. Are we anywhere near that this morning? I'm not against you. I didn't come here to fuss at you. I'm saying, are we slipping? The title of the message is, take your shoes off. Take your shoes off. Oh, up where I come from, up in Canada, in many homes, there is the custom that you take your shoes off when you enter the house. Some of the Canadian families have a sign. Please take your shoes off. And other homes that are more subtle place a 2-foot pile of shoes just in front of the door, just in case you don't get the message. And the pile of shoes in front of the front door is so high, you have to pole vault over it to get in their house. And then you find out there's only 2 people living there. But you get the point. These folk want you to take your shoes off. So you go ahead and you oblige. Now, I've never figured out if they do that in honor of an Eastern custom, and it's a lovely custom. I don't know if the Canadians do it in honor of an Eastern custom or in honor of the money paid for the new carpet or in honor of the comfort of people's feet, or I don't know if they do it in honor of the expense of the new parquet floor, but they say, take your shoes off, please. And so I don't know whether this morning to dedicate this sermon to Dr. Camp or to Dr. Spencer. Take your shoes off. I have a conviction against taking my shoes off in public. I got the conviction straight from Mother's interpretation of the Textus Receptus. Mother said, thou shalt never take thine shoes off in public, because thou mayest have an hole in thine sock. So I have a conviction against it. The perils of getting used to God are like the marriage where the husband is beginning to get used to his wife, or the wife is beginning to get used to her husband. It's just him. Just her. I expect her to make my breakfast, have my supper ready the instant I walk through the door. I really like 1957 Thunderbirds. I collect models of 57 Thunderbirds. And anyone who's to any degree wise does the same. But 57 Thunderbirds are not totally awesome. 57 Thunderbirds are not totally awesome. Only God is totally awesome. Oh Lord my God, when I am awesome, pause. Don't just run through it like a bunch of Baptists been singing it all your life. Oh Lord my God, when I am awesome, consider all the worlds thy hands have made. Then sing my soul, how great thou art. One of the old theologians said, let others wrangle, let others wrangle, fuss. I will wonder. William Quayle said, when wonder is dead, the soul becomes a dry bone. Don't let midterms kill your wonder. Don't let midterms make you like a bunch of dry bones. The midterms are designed to draw you toward the Lord. The midterms are designed to increase your wonder, not decrease it. These things have been built into the educational program of Ambassador to help you be in awe of God. And there'll be things out there in your ministry that will do their best to kick the awe of God out of you. Experiences that will leech on you and circumstances that will weigh you down. and eat into your private time with the Lord and eat into you praying with your deacons to take the wonder out of your heart and the wonder, the awe out of your ministry. Socrates said, wisdom begins in wonder. I want us to look at the basis or the grounds of the awesomeness of God. When we read the passage there in Exodus 3, we read that Moses was told to take off his shoes because he was standing on holy ground. Well, now let's look at the grounds for the awesomeness of God in Exodus 15. Would you turn there, please? Exodus 15. Exodus 15 and verse 1. Then sang Moses and the children of Israel this song unto the Lord. And spake, saying, I will sing unto the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. And now 15:11. Who is like unto thee, O Lord? Who is like unto thee, O Lord, among the gods? Glorious in holiness, fearful in praises, doing wonders. The words holiness and glorious come from the Hebrew word kadash. Kadash, which means separation, sanctification, or majestic cleanliness. You can't mess around in the dirt and be in awe of God. It cannot be done. You cannot go on living an unclean life and remain in awe of God. Kadash! God is separate. He's majestically clean from all the corruption and the dirt. This then is the attribute of God that gave rise to all the laws about the need for Israeli instruments and utensils to be kosher. They were to have kosher utensils and kosher plates and kosher bowls and kosher food because their God was clean. He was separate. Not like all the rest of the stuff. Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any love the world, the love of the Father is not him. To illustrate, though it's a poor illustration, let's suppose I had an old-fashioned, unsliced loaf of bread here. And I took a bread knife and I cut a slice off one end of that loaf of bread. And I took that one slice and I took it far, far, far away from the loaf. It's cut apart. It's cut away. It's by itself. That's the way it is with God. He's an infinite cut away and cut apart from unholiness and dirt. That's what holiness means. We could say it this way, to use a more contemporary phrase, God is an infinite cut above everyone and everything else. And so we need to be tender when we come into his presence. We need to be sensitive. I'm too sensitive. Is it possible that some of you are not sensitive enough? Long time ago, I decided it would be better to be too sensitive than not sensitive enough. I can move in the direction that I need to move in. But to not be tender of the awesome wholeness of God is dangerous ground. take off your shoes. Holiness is the balance of all the other attributes of God. I thank God for His love, and I thank God for every song about the love of God. But holiness is the overarching attribute of God. Holiness is what holds all the other attributes of God in sync or in balance. The new evangelicals are wrong when they say that the dominant thing about God is love. And that's why we're not new evangelical. We believe that the dominant attribute of God is His holiness. And that He will maintain His holiness come what may. And that the other attributes are held in sync by the overarching holiness of God. An old Scottish preacher said the following about the holiness of God. The holiness of God is the balance of all the other attributes. I call God's holiness, or His cut aboveness, the overarch. Power without holiness will degenerate into cruelty. God is omnipotent, all-powerful. True? God is omnipotent, all-powerful. But power without holiness will degenerate into cruelty. That's how we get a Hitler. That's how we get a Kim Jong-il, a Mussolini. Because power degenerates into cruelty. God is never cruel. But He will not sacrifice His holiness. Whom the Lord loveth, He chasteneth and scourgeth everyone whom He receiveth. The chastening of the Lord is the love of the Lord. And it's based on His overarching holiness. The reason we have unkind and sometimes brutal pastors in some Baptist churches is because they get carried away with their power. And they come to think that the sheep exist to serve them, when they're there to serve their sheep. And they don't keep their leadership under the authority of the holiness of God, which balances authority with compassion. The Scottish preacher continued, and he said, omniscience or all-knowingness without holiness becomes craft, deviousness, omniscience, knowing everything. You're not out of the woods if you're a genius this morning. Because all-knowingness, omniscience, without holiness becomes craft, manipulation. One of the most brilliant young men we had in the small Bible college where I went, his first name was Lynn, L-O-Y-N-N. He could do the Greek, the Hebrew, anything. But he knew he was smart. He tried to intimidate anyone that he viewed as intellectually inferior to him. He lorded it over his wife and lost his marriage because his wisdom, his science, his smarts without holiness became craft and intellectual superiority that his wife could not stand to live with. I don't like divorce, but I could not have put up with Lynn either. Have you ever met a really intelligent person who has warped his intelligence into craftiness? The infamous serial killer, Ted Bundy. Brilliant, genius. And he killed young women from the Northwest all the way to Florida. And his final victim was a young lady near the university in Gainesville, Florida. He was a genius. He was a self-taught lawyer. His smarts, his intelligence, his brilliance became an example of intelligence without the throttle of holiness. He was real smart. He was a genius. But his being a genius was not held in check by the holiness of God. You see, porn got him. And he was interviewed for Faith for the Family, Focus on the Family. And he said it was porn that got him. A genius, apart from holiness. A genius who went to seed and just developed new methods of torturing and killing young women. Justice, to consider another attribute of God. Justice without holiness will degenerate into revenge. I'm for justice. I have a strong sense of what is fair. I'm almost always for the underdog. I'm a mercy shower. I don't like to see anyone hurt or pained. Justice without holiness will degenerate into revenge. I have it coming to me. They did me wrong. No, holiness says leave them to God. If they did you wrong, leave them to God. He will repay, the Lord says. By contrast, goodness. Goodness without holiness would be passionate and intemperate fondness that would lead to nothing but mischief. We're talking about permissiveness. We're talking about the liberals who try to say, well, we're just going to be good to people. They shouldn't have to work. They should just keep getting their check. People shouldn't have to work. People shouldn't have to stand in line to become citizens of the United States of America. Let's just be good and have warm fuzzies about everybody. And so the culture disintegrates from the core. Goodness without holiness is passionate and intemperate fondness that leads to mischief and spoiled brats. America is drowning in spoiled brats because of what people mistakenly say. Well, that's the goodness of our heart. Now, I want to say, as I'm coming close to the end, that my prayer for you as students this semester and in the future will be that you'll always remember to take your shoes off in the presence of God, to keep your Jane and I pray the same thing for our grandchildren every day. We have four grandchildren who are virtually growing up in the church house. God has blessed the academy more than we ever imagined. God has given the school close to 250 students. It's only 10 years old. Neither I nor our son is smart enough to do what God is doing with the academy. New folks are joining the church. But our four grandchildren are growing up in the building. That's where they go to school. That's where they go to church. Sometimes they have youth activities there. And I pray that they'll never get used to God. If you let the chapel services make you hard and used to God, you're missing the whole point of chapel. If you get used to these hymns, and I just respect Dr. Reams' love of the hymns. He uses some gospel songs, and I'm glad he does. But he'll never let go of the doctrinal hymns. And my concern for every one of you and me. I'm not immune. Is that you're just going to get to the place where you stop taking your shoes off. Just, God. God. Blood of Jesus. Most of us don't do this at ball games, and I'm for baseball, and I'm especially for hockey. But most of us don't do this in hockey. Why do we do this to God? How about taking our shoes off and keeping that, oh, no matter how often we're in church. Dr. Childs still has his O. And that's good. That'll preach. That'll preach. I'm talking about Dr. Childs. That'll preach far more eloquently than anything I could ever say. He hasn't lost his O. He's going to go to heaven with his shoes off. He's going to go to heaven saying,